like to begin by acknowledging my co-investigator on this project, Dr. Shannon Frateroli at Hopkins with me. Today I'm going to provide a little bit of background on this program and evaluation that we are applying the sampling method to. I'm going to talk about some sampling strategies to identify hidden populations, which is what we are actually targeting in our evaluation. I'm going to describe respondent-driven sampling, talk about some strengths and challenges of this method, and then I'll get to the punchline, how we should think about using this for injury and violence research. So UTEC, the United Teen Equality Center, this is actually located up in Lowell, Massachusetts, which is about 35 miles northwest of Boston. And UTEC was created in 1999 as a safe haven for young people. For those of you who aren't familiar with Lowell, they have actually a lot of violence going on there, particularly amongst Latino and Cambodian young people. It has actually the third largest Cambodian population in the country, which I didn't know before I started to spend a lot of time up there. And about 20% of Lowell's population is between the ages of 13 and 23. So when you have a population that, and sorry, the total N for that is 100,000. So when you have so many young people and you're having issues with gang and with gang violence, it was great that this organization was created as a home, and they use street outreach workers to encourage positive youth development, provide alternatives to violence and gang life, and to mediate disputes. The activities of the outreach workers are governed by this conceptual model, and just to highlight, they really focus on intensive follow-up, which is right in the middle of our diagram here, and they look at crisis opportunities that happen to youth, whether it's somebody being arrested or being evicted from their home, disputes with families, as an opportunity to intervene, to try to create positive change and some guidance. And the street outreach workers do intensive follow-up in terms of in-person visits, phone calls, meeting with networks that young person is associated with, and they might connect you with resources. A lot of individuals need shelter. They need jobs. And so the outreach workers are really working hard to try to connect the young people with local resources in Lowell. Here's a couple of my outreach workers. The gentleman in the middle is the executive director, Greg Coutreau, and the outreach workers do wear orange coats in the winter time, and they're wearing orange shirts in the rest of the year, which in Lowell is not very often because it's so cold. But I was up there in Maine. It snowed, actually, which was crazy. But anyway, I actually think that their efforts seem to be really effective, in part because what's so amazing about this program, like a ceasefire model, the outreach workers look like the young people in terms of demographics, in terms of gender, in terms of life experiences. So when you have someone who's a former gang member who spent a lot of time in prison trying to talk to somebody who's thinking about getting out of a gang, I can't do that effectively. I've never been in a gang. But if you can take an outreach worker who's had those experiences, they can convey to the young person about post-prison life, you can get a job, you can still provide for your family, and those connections have really been beneficial to date. So we think. So we were actually funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to evaluate this program, my colleague Shannon and I, and myself, and we had three specific aims, and the first was to document the activities of the outreach workers, the second was to assess the impact on the youth in Lowell, and the third was to develop a model illustrating how the program might impact youth violence. And it's the second aim that I'm going to talk about, how we related the sampling method to. So to address our second aim, we decided to target a sample of about 250 youth. We were looking to get a representative sample to ask them the questions about their awareness of UTEC and outreach workers, their perceptions of the outreach workers. The outreach workers are concerned that the young people think of them as snitches, and so they think that they might not disclose information as openly as they might to somebody else. They also wanted to know about their interactions with the outreach workers and how they actually go about reducing and mediating youth violence, and also wanted to learn about what are some of the unmet needs of youth in terms of shelter and medical care and some things that maybe the outreach workers aren't helping them with. And the biggest challenge for us is that when we think about something like simple random sampling, we're able to enumerate our sampling frame. And oftentimes, we have methods that allow us to figure out, really, and look at the most accessible parts of the populations. So what happens when a large part of the population is not accessible? How do we get to them? So we actually evaluated and looked at some of the more commonly used methods to address hidden populations. We looked at venue-based sampling, where we thought about, can we hang outside of the high school there and really target individuals? We thought about time-based sampling or targeted or snowball sampling. And we decided that all of these methods had some limitations, namely in the non-randomness of the resulting sample, and also the fact that, again, we might not be able to access those individuals who are more hidden, the ones that, and we wanted those experiences as well. So it's probably about two summers now, my co-investigator was at a talk, and this gentleman from who's doing some work overseas was talking about how he used this method of respondent-driven sampling to identify commercial sex workers for a study of HIV prevention. And she called me, and we started to talk about this, and things developed, and we said, well, maybe this is a way that we can actually try to get the youth in our evaluation. So RDS is a really new method. It was only developed about 10 years ago by sociologist Douglas Heckathorn up at Cornell University, and he was working on a study of intravenous drug users and really felt that the methods we had for sampling were not appropriate for him to try to get access to this hidden population. And RDS is developed on the premise that peers are better than outreach workers and, yes, researchers at recruiting members of hidden populations. And in essence, what happens with this method is that a peer, a respondent, they recruit their own peers. So versus saying, go fill out this survey, go join this research project, they're actually going to do the recruitment for us. As in network-based samplings, and actually what happens is the researchers, we keep track of who recruited whom, we keep track of the numbers of social networks, and there's actually a lot of statistical modeling that's applied to this method, and it actually produces weights for the sample to account for the non-random initial recruitment patterns. RDS has some key unique components. The first one is the selection of seeds. I'll talk about this a little more in the next slide. But these are the individuals who are starting the recruitment process. I mentioned earlier already the recruitment of peers by their own peers. There's recruitment quotas. Each person typically can only recruit up to 3 individuals. And there's a double incentive system. So this is very, very costly. Normally, you compensate one person for filling out a survey of, $10 is normally what the literature says. So let's say Steve goes in and he fills out the survey and I say, here's $10 for filling this out, thank you. And then I give Steve 3 unique coupons and say, you go give this to 3 of your friends. And for each of those individuals who comes in to fill out a survey, they'll get $10 and you'll get $10 more for each of those 3 people. So ultimately, you can walk away with $40, which is pretty good for somebody who's 15 or 16 years old who might not have a job. And to get over the fact that we weren't allowed to give cash, we actually connected with some local vendors, a sneaker store, places where kids shop to get gift cards exchanges, so therefore they can also support local businesses. So here's just a small model. And so these are our 5 seeds. And the seed selection takes a long time. We really had to spend a lot of time in Lowell, more time than I would have ever thought, in terms of really understanding the population. And choosing seeds from the different groups that we were targeting. First, we had a homeless seed. We had a Latino female gang member. We had a Hispanic male gang member. And we were choosing these individuals. And so let's look at this first seed right here. This person would give coupons to 3 people. And this is our first wave of recruitment. These individuals would then go on and pass coupons and so forth to our second wave and third wave and so forth. And this is the way, very simplistically, that this model works, and oftentimes you might see schematics that really show the different genders or race, and these models can get very, very, very intricate, and I'll provide a reference at the end if you're interested in learning a little bit more about this. So when I talk about this model, I normally have 3 common questions. The first, well, that's great, Keisha, how long does it take? The second, does it yield a representative sample? And the third, can you produce population estimates? So my response to the first question is, it depends. The response to the second and third questions are, yes, but it also depends on the following key factors. And these are the 5 factors that we need to really think about, and I'll just go through each of these briefly. The first is the seed selection. I think oftentimes we as researchers might not spend enough time doing the formative research to actually accurately identify the seeds. It takes a long time to really try to understand the population. And it's important to pick out seeds who are known in the community and who have enough social networks, because if you have an inactive seed, you're not going to recruit anybody. The second thing is there's this concept called network homophily, which says that contacts between similar people occur at a higher rate than non-similar people. So, of course, you want to have high homophily in your study. And you can actually measure this. There's this homophily index that you can actually produce based on what you learn about the network and the analysis. And the strength of the homophily is actually going to directly relate to the rate of waves. If you have strong homophily, you will actually get to that first, second, third, fourth, fifth wave fairly quickly. If you look in the literature, to recruit a sample of 250 or 300 people has taken anywhere from 3 weeks up to 6 months, depending on your initial seed selection. And the benefit of this method is if you actually see that your seeds are not being effective, you can go ahead and pick new seeds again. And as long as you're documenting this process, you can help to measure the networks. The fourth concept really relates to this thing called equilibrium. And the statistical theory that RDS is based on, it's really a combination of Markov chain theory and a bias network theory. And it says that if peer recruitment proceeds through a sufficiently large number of waves, we're talking about anywhere from 12 to 20 waves, the composition of that sample theoretically is going to stabilize so that it's independent of the initial seeds that were selected. And now when I talked to the developer of this method, I was like, huh, you know, how is that going to work? And he convinced me and one of the other developers and a lot of mathematical models and talked to the statisticians. And I felt even more convinced when I learned that you can produce standard errors from this to actually develop confidence intervals about how confident you are in terms of your recruitment processes. And in the end, when it works, you should have a sample that's more representative of that hidden population which you were trying to target in the first place. I think this method has some strengths. Again, an ability to reach hard-to-reach populations, particularly when we think about individuals that are oftentimes marginalized or not actually easily accessible. The fact that you have peer recruitment based on pre-existing relationships is very important. You can oversample for specific subpopulations. For example, we knew that we wanted to have enough women, so one of our seeds, again, was a particular type of female. And one of the other great things in picking the seeds was that we worked really closely with our outreach workers who know the population better than we do to really think about who are going to be those individuals that we can pick for the seeds. I've learned you can make inferences to the population. If you do, we're not doing that for this particular study. We're using this to identify study participants. Again, this hasn't been done before for injury or violence, and it's exciting to think about the possible applications of this in a broader context. Again, with the reliance on some strong biostatistical theory, you can develop standard errors. I mean, that is, if you are interested in seeing all those equations, I have them, but I'm sure you don't want them. I mean, Steve showed us enough equations, I think, today, and I appreciate them as a fellow quantitative person. And I think one of the other things is because software is so expensive, it's free downloadable software, which is always a plus when you have limited funding to do projects. There are some challenges, though. As I mentioned earlier, this problem of inactive seeds. I mean, when you think about, you spend all this time trying to pick the people who you think are going to recruit enough people, and require strong social networks. And so when you do your formative research, you're having to ask questions like, how many people do you know? Who do you hang out with? And really try to get a sense of, is this person connected enough in the community? There was one of the papers on RDS said that one of the benefits of this method is that you actually don't need to spend a lot of time doing formative assessment of the population because the peers are recruiting the peers. You're not going into the population. I completely disagree with that. I actually think that you need to spend a lot of time on the formative assessment in order to accurately pick your seeds. This can be very expensive. Our time in terms of our double incentives and that we actually allotted to this process, it's about $10,000 that we have for incentives alone. It's complicated. We need extensive staff oversight. We had to hire somebody up in Lowell because Hopkins is in Baltimore. And so as much time I spend up there, we do have somebody who's on site. And also we have to figure out how are we going to collect the data, how are we going to administer the survey. Ultimately, we have an online system where people actually come in and sit at a computer and they're actually completing the survey. And we had to think about, well, is that the most accurate way to do it versus some sort of paper survey? And, of course, there are clear ethical issues and human subjects issues. And the punchline for us, as I realize my time is about to end, is that I think that this is a method that we need to think more about for those of us who do injury and violence research, particularly when we're trying to identify individuals who are, quote-unquote, hidden populations. Vulnerable populations are most oftentimes hidden populations. those are often the populations, too, that are disproportionately affected by certain injury and violence topics. I think that we can think about this for youth, particularly street youth. It's been used in the past for studies of commercial sex workers and HIV amongst homeless populations as well. And I think also there might be some applications when we think about migrant farm workers or other types of individuals, other populations who are a little bit harder to figure out what their sampling frame is. Oops. I want to just end by acknowledging our funder, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, our program officer, Dr. Lane Cassidy, the individuals with the United Teen Equality Center in Lowell. And I've been very fortunate that I connected with Dr. Abdul Qadar down at the CDC, who was one of the initial developers of this method. And he's been a great mentor to me and an advisor in terms of rolling out this method. He's excited that people in other disciplines outside HIV are really thinking about using this. And if you're interested in learning more about the method, there was a special issue of the Journal of Urban Health published last year. And it has a number of different papers about this particular method. And that's it. If you have any questions that I can't get to today, feel free to contact me via email or give me a call. Thank you very much.